Today, I want to take you back 9,000 years. This is a time when humans first settled at a place called Çatalhöyük in what we now know as Turkey. At that time, it was a wetland teeming with fish, water birds, with herds of wild animals roaming on higher ground. It looked like a kind of paradise. And it was here that humans built some of the very first villages anywhere on Earth. And there were no streets in this village. Instead, the houses clustered together like a honeycomb. Archaeologist Serena Love has spent a lot of time climbing into the history of Çatalhöyük. Serena, welcome to Conversations.
Great, thank you. It's nice to be here.
Tell me where you grew up.
I grew up in Southern California, Orange County.
And so how did you first get interested in the ancient world from Southern California?
Oh, I blame my parents.
It's always a good defense.
Absolutely. Both my parents were school teachers, and so I got in any kind of interest that I had, they would feed. And I think I remember in second grade being introduced to King Tut.
By a teacher?
Yeah, reading it in class. And I must have come home all excited, because then a few years later, my parents took me to the pyramids in Mexico. We flew down, I think it was 1984, because it was after the earthquake, the big earthquake they had in Mexico City, because I remember looking at the devastation there. And then we drove out to Teotihuacan, out to the pyramids there, and I got to climb them. And
wow.
Back in the day when I think you still could climb the pyramids there, and we went down to Cancun, and we went to see some of the Mayan ruins out there, and it was spectacular. And I think ever since then I was hooked.
How did those pyramids in Mexico compare to the pictures you would have been looking at in your books as a kid at primary school? What are those pyramids like?
They're stepped. So they were actually more meant to be temples, and they would actually perform ceremonies and ritual activity on the top of the pyramids, whereas like Egyptian pyramids were burial places where you would just put the king inside of it, and then that was it. Then its function was complete. Of course, I didn't know that then.
So what was it that you loved about them? Were it cool structures or what?
Just, you had so many questions about them that no one really had answers for. And I don't know, I was just fascinated by these monuments and these ancient people and who they were and how they lived and all that. Just, I couldn't get enough.
Did you even have a name to know what it was that you were excited by as a kid?
No, not at all. I think in grade 7... I decided I was good at history and I was good at science. So I said, I'm going to be an historical scientist when I grow up. And then I found out that there was a thing called archaeology, and that was it. Then I was on the road. There was no stopping me.
Once you had that word. So yeah. Once you knew it, did you, was there ways that you could read more or learn more as a kid? What were you doing?
Yeah, I remember my mom got me a subscription to Archaeology magazine when I was about 15 or 16. And then just the whole world exploded, because now I'm finding out about societies in Cambodia and, and more about the Mayan. I could actually read articles about these ancient people all around the place. And then I got hooked. I found an advertisement in one of the magazines for the Egypt Exploration Society. And so I wrote my letter and I said, I want to become a member. And I had my mom write me a check and we sent it off to London. And then years and years later, I met one of the administrators from the Egypt Exploration Society. And he said that I was the youngest member of the group ever, of the society. And then I held the record up until very recently, where some 14-year-old beat me out. So,
what did your membership of the Egyptian Exploration Society mean in practice?
It means I got the newsletters. This was obviously all snail mail, and it would just take forever because it was always coming from London. So by the time it was written and issued and actually in my hot little hands was months later. And then I got the glossy magazine, and then there was the big journal, which was a bit too technical for me at 16, but I still have them diligently. I still have them.
You still have them now?
I still have them. They've moved 3 countries with me. I can carry them everywhere, sadly.
Are you still a paid-up member of the Egyptian Exploration Society?
No. Sadly, no.
You let that subscription lapse.
That subscription lapse. There are very many societies around that are all very worthy, and I can't, yeah. I can't keep up with all the reading.
you might be getting a cranky letter from them.
Yeah,
were you also a fan of, like, were you one of those kids then who were Raiders of the Lost Ark was something for you, or were you already too serious an archaeologist?
I think I was pretty sure that was all fiction by then, and I just wasn't. It was an enjoyable
that was amateur compared to your memberships, Serena.
Absolutely.
So you then did go on to study archaeology at university. Where were you? Where did you go?
Sure. So I started at the University of California at Berkeley because it had a program in Egyptology. So from my second year at university, I was studying hieroglyphs and learning how to read hieroglyphs. And I think there's a permanent stoop in my back because of the book that I had to carry around, which was an absolute mammoth, which conveniently has been rewritten. So I'm still bearing the load on my back.
Maybe it was meant to give you a first-hand experience of what those pyramid builders
carrying all those weight. Yeah, so for 2 years I had to carry this giant book around. So I was at the University of California at Berkeley, and then when I arrived there during O week, they said, you know, we have a study abroad program, and I thought, oh my gosh, do you do Egypt? And they said, yes, of course. So I was just, by the end of the day, I had filled out the paperwork, and my third year I was at the American University in Cairo, and I was 20 years old, and I had no idea what I was getting myself into. And I signed up for a summer school class and to speak Arabic, but that class didn't have enough people, so it got canceled. So I got there not knowing the language, not really knowing much about Islam and Islamic practices and just Arab society in general. And I was 20 years old and just thrown into this from, you know, a middle-class suburban girl, had no clue what I was doing. And it was a really rough learning curve.
Really? What was the toughest bit?
Just getting to sense of myself, you know, at 20 and 20, I had my 21st birthday in Cairo, and just, it was the best experience, but difficult.
Yeah.
And just difficult. Cairo, I still find Cairo a difficult city because it's very crowded and it's very noisy and it's very loud and it's just the hustle and bustle and it never stops. Like, it never, 24 hours the city is. And I think at heart, I'm just not a city girl. I lived a year in Istanbul as well, and I had the same kind of complaint. Like, it's an amazing, vibrant city. I'm just not a city girl, and it's just a bit too much for me.
Just turn down the vibrancy.
Ooh,
just a notch
just
or two.
A little bit.
What was your first encounter with the Egyptian pyramids like? Do you remember the first time you saw them?
Oh, absolutely. It was just mesmerizing. We were in a taxi, and a couple of us that were all studying Egyptology had gotten a taxi together, and then there they were, and you can just see them little poking out from behind the apartment blocks, and you're just, you know, like kind of like you're a famous person on the stage. You're just trying to get around everyone, get a better view, and there they were, and we were just gobsmacked, and we got on horses, and we got convinced to get on some horses, and then we were there at sunset, and it was just like being transported to somewhere else, because you have all the, you know, it's been in your mind for so long, and we had been studying it, and just in your imagination, but to see it in the flesh, so to speak, was just like no other experience.
When they're there, I've never been to visit the pyramids. Is there a stillness about them? What's the kind of atmosphere that surrounds those huge structures?
Well, unfortunately, it's on the outskirts of Cairo, so you've still got the noise and the honking and the call to prayer. It was actually quite magical because where you are on the pyramids, when the call to prayer goes off, there's about 8 different mosques that all go off, and they're all singing the same call, but they go off at slightly different times, and the singer is all slightly different. So you get this kind of cacophony of the call to prayer, but then you've got people coming up to you and selling their goods and stuff. So it's not this kind of quiet, contemplative moment that we were all hoping for. It was a bit more than that.
And what did you learn differently through going to Egypt and being there in the flesh, differently than what you'd learned through all your study and all your poring over heavy textbooks?
Yeah, it's. I think I learned me personally, I deal really well with learning things in person. So it just makes more sense. So when someone says, oh, you know, the entrance is on the south side, I can visualize that. I know exactly where the entrance is. And if I see any photograph, I know the orientation of the photographer. I know which way this picture was taken. And it's just being able to place it in time and space and just being able to feel it for yourself and being able to, I don't know, I just understand things better if I've seen it and experienced it rather than just looking at a picture. It just doesn't, or hearing a lecture, it just doesn't mean the same, because now I can orient to myself and I remember seeing images or the texts on the walls or the inscriptions of the kings. It's unforgettable.
How do contemporary modern Egyptians see that history? What's their opinion in relationship to it?
I think that's a very individual question, but the people that I've worked with, they're very proud, because several of them, because they're Muslim, they step back from it and they recognize that it's their deep history, but they're proud of it and they own it. You know, there's a sense of very strong sense of nationalist pride.
After Egypt, Serena, you spent a lot of time while you were doing your PhD at this site, Çatalhöyük in Turkey. Whereabouts is it in Turkey? Give us a sense of its location.
Sure. So it's in central Anatolia. It's outside the modern city of Konya, and it's about a 9-10 hour drive outside of Istanbul. So Istanbul is right on the west coast, way up in the north west corner, and then basically you drive into the central part of the country, and it's right in the middle.
Right in the middle. How did you get there when you would go on digs there? How would you travel there?
Yeah, so it was a nice long flight from San Francisco to usually a layover in Germany, from Germany to Istanbul. And then if I was going by myself, then I would just either take an overnight bus, which was really dreadful because it's difficult to sleep, but preferably the sleeper train. And then if I was meeting up with, I was teaching a field school, so I would meet up with my students, and then we'd, as a whole big group of about 8-9 of us, we would get the overnight train. So
is there still a romance about those overnight trains at that time?
Yeah, absolutely. It would feel like you're kind of reliving the Orient Express, but maybe in its faded glory.
So still sort of old wallpaper and
peeling in the corners, yeah, and crackling paint a bit, yeah. It's just not quite the same as it used to be. And now that train, I believe, has been replaced with the high-speed rail. So I don't even know if that overnight train goes anymore. My last trip out from Ankara to Konya in 2016, we took the high-speed train, and it's just very flash and very quick, and the chairs are very modern, not what it used to be.
When you would arrive at the Konya plane, what does it look like now?
It's very flat. It's a flat agricultural plain. Those of us from the U.S. who were on the project would always say that it was like the breadbasket of the middle of the U.S., where it's just flat and very agricultural. The Konya Plain is surrounded, but it's like 150 kilometers of surrounded by mountains. And so the inside is this basin where all the water kind of channels into, and there's a few major rivers that go through it. So it's flat with really good fertile soils, which makes it good for crops. But it's always been that way. And so this is maybe one of the reasons why the early settlement was there.
Are there any signs, just looking at it now from the surface, of those civilizations that existed there in the past?
It's unmistakable. Because the landscape is so flat, you have these mounds, which are called tells, and those mounds from top to bottom are all archaeology. And so when the first surveys were done out in this area in the 50s, you could just see all these little bumps in the landscape, and sometimes the bump is only a couple of meters, but the Çatalhöyük bump, so to speak, is 24 meters. So it's very prominent, and there's a few of these kind of hills in the landscape, and they're all archaeology. So Höyük actually means mound.
And are there farms now actually around those mounds, or is it a cleared area for archaeology?
The mound itself has no crop on it, but it's surrounded by fields.
And when did archaeologists start looking at this area?
So in 1954, it was kind of the first survey by Braidwood and a few other British archaeologists from the British Institute in Ankara. And they went out and and just wanted to see what was out there. And they were recording all these mounds, and then and they were all ages, so from the very old Neolithic through to the Byzantine periods, and a few in between, several in between. But in 1958, it was declared that there's no Neolithic in this area. And then there was a British archaeologist, James Mellart, who went just like, oh, he had his doubts. So he went out there and found the Çatalhöyük Mound and found that it had Neolithic pottery at the bottom of the mound and Neolithic pottery at the top. And so that's when he said, no, this one's Neolithic.
So what do we mean by Neolithic? When are we talking about?
So that Neolithic meaning New Stone Age. And so this time period in this region is after the last ice age. So it's starting around 10,000 years ago. But the actual settlement is about 9,000 and 8,000 years ago.
So this area has been settled by people right way back from just after the end of the last
ice age
all the way through ever
yeah.
since.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So there are layers in those mounds, are there, of
different
periods?
Mounds. So the Çatalhöyük Mound is just Neolithic, but there are multiple mounds around the place that then date to the Copper Age and then Bronze Age, and then Bronze Age goes into Iron Age and then Iron Age, and it goes on and on.
How incredible. It almost sounds like a kind of a layer cake, some of those parts mm-hmm. that archaeologists dig through.
Uh-huh.
So the process of starting to dig there, Serena, what are you actually digging with? What are your tools?
Well, the first thing we go and do is we do something like with ground penetrating radar. So the first thing you want to do is before you actually start actually digging into it,
put down your shovel
and you get the geophysics team out, and they want to look at what's buried in the ground first, so you can kind of map it out underneath the soil and underneath the grass, and then you can get an idea of what that instrument will look for is density of buried things. So then you can say, okay, these are probably walls, and then you can target your...
So that doesn't actually show up outlines or
it will show outlines, yeah. It better if it's stone. In this case, it was mud brick. But sometimes at Çatalhöyük, the stuff was literally right under the surface. So if you just took a hoe, just a simple hoe, and just started scratching back, you could see the outlines of the bricks. And because it had the white plaster on the inside, you'd see this really nice rectangular white outline. You're like, well, that's the house.
Wow, just underneath the surface.
Just underneath the surface.
Do you have to be very delicate then when you...
Oh, absolutely. A lot of times we would dig, you take your shoes off, because even your footprint, and especially if it was wet, because then you could remove 200 layers on the bottom of your foot if it was muddy. So you had to be tread lightly.
And are you working with a team of people next to each other? How is it set out? Like, are you given a spot to focus on?
Sure. So because it's all houses, each of us we'd work in little pods, two or three people per group. But the team itself was huge. It had over, probably throughout its lifespan, about 300 people working in and out on it. And it was a multinational team. So it started off being based at Cambridge. And then when Professor Ian Hodder moved to Stanford, it became a Stanford-based project. And that's when I became part of it, when I started my PhD at Stanford with Ian Hodder. But the little teams would have professional archaeologists, and it would have academics, and it would have undergraduates. And so we tried to pair up the professionals with the undergrads. But then there's this team of specialists, and that's what I was. I was one of the architectural specialists, but we'd also have specialists in conservation or of the artwork and of the human remains and of the plant remains and of the animal remains and the stone tools. And then, it was amazing.
What happens when someone strikes something, when someone uncovers something?
Yeah, so I was excavating building 49 and I came across a burial, and I don't have much experience with burials, and so they basically took me off of it and brought in the human remains person. But this was a later grave, so the Roman era would came back in later and used it as a cemetery, because there was a glass bottle at the foot of this individual, and it was a very, very delicate glass vase. And so we had our conservation team come in, and they would kind of wrap it and protect it so that they could excavate it in one piece, because if I was left to myself, I probably would have just broken it.
I'm glad you realized
time.
Is it exhausting work? Like, physically, are you bent over and is it hot? What's the
climate?
It's
very hot. So you're talking about, it'll be in the 40s for most of the summer. We work under now there's a permanent shelter, but at the time we just had tarps that we would put up, so you're working under shade, which was nice because you would get the breeze. But depending on what you're excavating, sometimes you're on your belly and you're excavating at arm's length, you know, or sometimes you're just all crouched up, so you're sitting on your bum and you're digging between your feet. Or
between carrying the Egyptian textbook and this, I think you need to have like a team of physios connected with every archaeologist
and masseuse. If we could have an on-site masseuse, would be amazing. But I was actually known because I would get up early and practice yoga. And for doing that was mostly so that I would feel comfortable in these cramped positions all day while excavating.
So while you were excavating, Serena, you were coming across animals. Mm. What sort of animals and why?
Sure. So at this time, goats and sheep were domesticated, and this was part of a big part of the diet. Pig were around, and they were wild. Horses were around, and they were also wild. And there are some deer. These were all wild species. There's also a wild auroch, which is
What's
now extinct.
Auroch?
It's the modern cow, but twice the size. So it was a big guy. And it was domesticated in the process of being domesticated. So it was a massive cow, and you would find these knuckle joints that were, you know, twice as large as the modern one.
How momentous a moment is this in human history, this domestication of animals? What happened to allow that, and what did it mean for us?
Yeah, so before, you know, hunter-gatherers, you were following the herds, but now you have the herd staying next to you. And it means a lot because now you don't have to move around chasing after the animals. You've got them penned in, and you're being able to use them for actually different products. So now you've got milk. So you actually now have a relationship with an animal such that you can touch it. And the reason that that's important, because a wild animal is going to run away and freak out and kick you and, you know, bite and scratch you and, you know, do its best to get away. But now with a domestic animal, you can actually reach it and touch it and be able to milk it. And so now we've got milk as a product. And before, you know, you would hunt an animal and you would kill it and skin it. And so that was good for its skin and then all of its products. But now you could cut the fleece off, not the fleece, because that would be killing it, but you could cut the wool off of a sheep and actually use it. And then the fleece would grow back, or the wool would grow back. And so it's a very different interaction and relationship with the animal that we didn't have before.
And why at this moment and this place do archaeologists think, why did domestication start to happen?
Well, it's through the region. So in some places there were pigs that were domesticated. There's a great site further to the east where they say that bacon was domesticated before bread.
This is a holy site for many people.
bacon before bread. Yeah. It was kind of the tagline for a while. And it's just, I don't know, the domestication process. I mean, because remember, plants are being domesticated at the same time. And I think a lot of it is a part of just people's attitudes towards the environment are starting to shift, and they're settling down. So a lot of their behaviors are shifting, and they're building permanent architecture. And that's also the thing that's changing. So the people are changing, the plants are changing, but also they're not nomadic anymore. So they're actually building substantial architecture.
So let's talk about the architecture that was being built from 9,000 years ago in this region in central Turkey. What was unusual to our eyes about the way these houses looked?
First of all, there's no door. So that would be the most unusual thing, is that you have to enter the house through the roof. So the outside of the houses, these were mud brick houses, very big, thick, 30-centimeter thick bricks, but relatively thin and long, and they would stack them up and plaster the inside of the houses. But then you didn't plaster the outside, because then the outside is another neighbor abutting right up to yours. So you have these very thick walls, but with this white plaster. And we're not sure if there is windows or not, but you would enter down from the rooftop on a ladder.
So how would you get up to the rooftop? Is there a ladder on the outside as well?
Yeah, presumably that you would probably have to, there has to be some sort of ladder or pathway from the base of the mound, like if you went out to the river, or at, you know, just leaving the mound in general, then somehow climbing up. And we don't have anything like stairs or anything, but we do know that they were building ladders out of wood.
And ladders out of wood, so that means I'm guessing you don't find any remains of the ladders, or are there any ways that you know?
No, we know that we have lots of remains of posts and post holes and of charcoal, so we know what kind of wood that there is around, and we just also from pollen and landscape reconstructions, we know what kind of wood there is. we don't have any ladders, but we know that there's a ladder scar. Because the walls were replastered so many times, the lip, the plaster would lip up around the ladder. And it was always on the south wall above the oven or the hearth, presumably because then the smoke from there could go up the hole in the ceiling.
And so how big was the hole at the top that people came in and out of?
It doesn't exist. We only essentially have the bottom, like the walls pretty much exist knee height, and that's about it.
And why no doors, Serena?
Good question. I don't have an answer.
It's a really important part of the house, the door.
I know. But it seems to be part of the region. There's a couple of villages that are similar to Çatalhöyük that are in northern Syria and Iraq, and they just didn't put doors in.
Would it have been good for protection, I'm guessing?
Or? Possibly, but from who?
This is Conversations with Sarah Kanoski on ABC Radio.
Once you climbed inside these houses, what did they look like?
Well, we know that the walls were plastered white. And sometimes there was artwork. So we have things like red stripes on walls, or sometimes handprints. So you put your hand on the wall and you paint red around your hand. We have geometric designs. We have houses with nothing, just plain white walls.
How has that remained from 7,000 years ago? How is the paint still there?
No idea.
So it really, like,
I don't know.
You uncover the dirt and the earth, and that you can see the red and the white paint.
Mm. And they would replaster it often. So what sometimes is the outer plaster has come off, and so the buried painting will be there. But what we've also seen is that that they will do a whitewash, and then we'll repaint the image, and then they'll whitewash it and repaint the image. So sometimes these walls have been plastered up to 300-400 times. And this white clay that they're using is local. It's locally available. It's abundant. Inside, it's probably dark. They've got all sorts of things presumably hanging on the walls. Things drying, storage, you know, things in it, maybe skin bags being suspended from the ceiling. We think the ceilings are modern height, about 8-9 feet, so 2.5-3 meter high. But the rooms are small; they're about 4.5 square meters, and it's mostly a dirt floor. Sometimes one of the floors would be plastered white as well, but the thing you notice immediately when you enter one of these houses is it's quiet because of the really thick walls, and the ambient temperature will be constant, so it'll be very comfortable. Even if it's snowing outside or if it's 40 degrees outside, once you enter one of these mud brick houses, it'll be very comfortable, about 18 degrees, and probably dark. We presume one idea for the white plastered walls is to reflect light. But then, I don't know, we don't know if there is windows or not.
It almost sounds like a cocoon the way that you describe it, entering through the top and being in that one space. Mm. With the decorations, you mentioned handprints, but also a red stripe. Is there any theory about what that could have been symbolizing or meaning?
In other cultures, sometimes the red stripe is liminal space, like between us and another world. But this is a pre-literate society. They're not writing. So it's really difficult to kind of get at that cognitive belief to interpret what the meaning is behind it. Other artwork that has survived from the first excavation in the 60s and then into the recent one has been scenes of hunting. So you get images of kind of like stick figures of men, mostly men, who are chasing a wild boar, and it's pulling at its tail and it's pulling at its tongue and trying to trip it up at its feet. And then there's another one where it's chasing a large deer. And it's all disproportionate. The size of the deer is, you know, twice the size as the humans. You've got these little human stick figures running around chasing the animal. And then one of the more famous ones is a picture of a vulture, presumably of a vulture picking a head off of a skeleton. And so you have this headless body with this vulture picking at it. And
I've read that one of those images is considered the first map or a very early map. Mm-hmm. Is that correct? Is that something that archaeologists can know?
Well, I think that comes down to a matter of interpretation. I like to think of it as a map. I agree that it looks like a plan of the village, because it's all these little boxes and it has all this space around the boxes, and it really does look like, it's not an exact figure of what the houses look like, but it could be seen as how they interpreted their world and their village. But again, without writing, it's really difficult to tell if that's what it meant or not.
Have they found, or have archaeologists found other examples of art, figurines, for example, or statuettes?
Sure. So there's a Lynn Meskel from Stanford University. That was her role on the team. It was the figurines. And there are several of these so-called goddess figurines, these kind of corpulent females with big breasts and big tummies and big thighs.
How big are they?
They're only about 10, 15 centimeters. Sometimes they don't have heads. Sometimes they have removable heads. There would be a hole in it, kind of like Barbie, and you could switch, you know.
Wow.
And maybe it was for different occasions, and you have a happy one and a sad one and a, I'm not really sure, but they could just be for different festivals, and so different purposes, you give it a different head. But then lots of animal figurines, and then other little figurines that we're not really sure what they are. They look like little birds or bird beaks, and they're just fashioned out of clay, and they're not very big, about 4 or 5 centimeters, but that's the bulk of it, are the animals and anthropomorphic figures.
And were people using stone in artistic ways as well as for stone tools?
A lot of the stone for the tools isn't local. It's being imported from a couple hundred kilometers away. It's that black obsidian volcanic glass. That's not local. The figurines are majority made out of clay. There's not a lot of stone in this area, so stone is a bit precious.
The images of the houses where archaeologists have you know, reconstructed models, they're so beautiful. Producer Nick was saying they're very Instagrammable. With that white, gleaming white walls and then this striking red contrast and an animal throw or something. I mean, it could be Vogue Living today, these houses. They had a good eye. Tell me about the bigger view of the city. Like if we zoom out from being inside those houses to looking over the city, are these houses separated by streets?
Presumably on the rooftops.
Would
have been the movement of the people, but because that's not what preserves, we don't really know. We don't know what the roofs would have looked like. We presume, so the kind of the reconstructions that we've done is that you have posts that are coming out of the building, and then there's probably a mud and reed and smaller wood branches kind of as a roof. And maybe are they flat or are they sloped? We have no idea. But then the summertime is really quite brutal, so we assume that they also had like porches or some sort of awnings so that you could be in the outdoor space but not in the direct sunlight. And then presumably you're just walking around on the rooftops. There's also garbage dumps that are inside the city. We call them a midden. And just think of it as a big compost pile. So the thing about the houses is they're immaculately clean as well. When we excavate them, you just expect them to be dirty and filled with garbage, and it's not there. And where it is in these middens, in these compost piles, if you like, and sometimes it's in an empty house. So when the houses were rebuilt, they would knock down the walls, and then they would rebuild it in the same space. But sometimes the house didn't get rebuilt, and we're not entirely sure why. And then that one just becomes filled with garbage, essentially. And so the years accumulate, and then eventually 100, 150 years later, someone sees an opportunity and builds a house on top.
So on this site, people kept building on top, building next to. Is that, it's described as looking like a honeycomb. How is that working? How is that happening?
The social mechanisms behind it, we're not really so sure about, but that's been one of the driving questions, is why does one house continue to get rebuilt in the same place over and over again, and how come the neighbor doesn't? And so, yeah, you've got empty houses and brand new houses and houses that were, built recently or have been lived in for a while, and they're all at different heights. Right? Because the mound is very organic, and so it's just kind of happening as needed, as maybe someone dies is what ends a house, or maybe it's a birth or a traumatic event, or goodness knows, there's so many ways to interpret why one house would finish. But yeah, they're all at different heights and at different phases of occupation, and the number of people inside each one, we assume that it's about 4 or 5 people is about what could fit comfortably. But they also have burials inside the house.
Well, just before we get to those, which is such a fascinating part of this story, the idea that people are moving from one to one primarily by the roof and travelling across that way. And in terms of building stuff on, I mean, I had a friend at high school whose family kept expanding, you know, a big Catholic family. They just kept building sort of bits onto the back of their house. You know, the outhouse became a bedroom, then a shed. Then, you know, this is not uncommon even now in terms of just tacking on structures at the end of things. If there may have been 4 or 5 people living individually in each structure, how many people together at this settlement at its height?
Sure. So the estimates range from conservative at 3,000 to 8,000 people. It's massive.
Yeah.
But if you think about where we were at hunter-gatherers about 2,000 years prior to this, you've got bands of 20 to 50 people, you know, hunting and living together, and now you've got people living together in big quantity. And so now you've got a lot of social mechanisms that need to start kicking in so that, you know, you don't, so that you can all deal with each other.
even the idea of a centralized garbage area, I mean, all of those sort of structures that populations require. You said there's no written language, no. Serena. Is there any idea about what language, though, these people spoke? Would it be connected to modern Turkish or Arabic?
No, probably not. And I don't know enough about the linguistics to know what would be in that area.
Tell me about what happened in this community when somebody died. What happened to the body?
So they get buried inside the house while the house is being occupied. But there's been some recent research that actually suggests that they may have been defleshed before going inside the house. So if you think of maybe Tibetan sky burials, where they would be left out on some sort of a platform and the birds would come and deflesh. And then the body would then be taken into...
So it's really then just bones...
But it's actually they go in articulated, so they eat the flesh, but they don't eat the tendons. So the bones are still all connected together. And it doesn't take long for these birds to deflesh a skeleton. It could be in less than a week because the bodies go into the graves inside the house very tightly, so they're very tightly flexed. And you wouldn't get that kind of tight flex if you still have skin on.
So when you say tightly flexed, you mean they're bound up? Were they tied in a certain position?
Some of them were tied and some of them are just kind of folded up. So you put your knees up to your chest and you put your ankle, you know, your heels right up against your bum. And so it's in like a fetus position and your hands are in front of you. And so you're basically your entire body becomes the size of your trunk because you've just been folded and then put into the ground. But then because obviously as people die repeatedly, you reopen the burial cut and then you add somebody else. And so you get multiple bodies inside of one house. And so you got this disarticulation because as you put the new person in, you kind of scatter the bones of the old person. But there's something that they're also doing, which is they're circulating human remains. So
what do you mean?
There's body parts missing, or there's too many body parts. So you do the count. So you excavate a grave, and let's say you have 6 skulls. So you should have all the body parts for 6 people, but then you have an extra arm, or there's an extra leg, and it's unaccounted for because you're like, well, there's no matching skull. So now I have the legs of 7 people, but I only have 6 skulls. Or you have the body parts for 8 people, but you only have 4 skulls. So there's a couple of skulls missing.
What's happening?
So there's... It's
answer me. This is quite perplexing to me.
I know. There's a trend in the region of skull removal. And it's... I mean, the current thinking is it's reverence. It's ancestor worship. The rest of the body parts we're not sure, but maybe that was a way to kind of keep your ancestors close to you, or maybe they deceased somewhere off-site, and so what you brought back with you was just an extra arm because the rest of them was maybe not salvageable. I don't know.
So, but a removed skull might, of a revered ancestor, might then move around different family members or different households.
Mm.
And when you say they were in the house, Serena, so I'm imagining this one room with the white plaster and the red handprints and the red stripe. Where are the skeletons? In what part of my house?
Floor.
So under the floor.
They're under your floor and underneath what we call the sleeping platforms. So you have your cooking area, which is what we call the dirty area, because there's like food remains and charcoal remains and such. And then there's the kind of a different area up on a platform. And by platform, I mean it's only raised mud by about 10 centimeters. And the plaster there is usually very white and very clean. And that's where the burials tend to be.
When archaeologists have studied those bones, have they worked out if the people buried together were all related?
We've tried DNA in the past and it hasn't been successful, but a study done of the teeth and the morphology of the teeth indicated that the men were all related to each other and the women weren't. And so the thinking is that it was a patrilineal society, so the men would stay put at marriage and the women were being brought in from other villages. And sometimes the people buried together are related and sometimes they're not. But that's the kinship structures of different cultures is very different than our own. So we do ours based on blood. I am the daughter to both of my parents. That's a blood relationship. But yet in other cultures, I could call somebody else my mother, even though we're not genetically related. And so I could be buried with this other woman. You see what I mean?
Who doesn't count as a relative in our way of structuring, but may have their... Yeah.
So genetically, these people aren't all related, but we don't have no idea what their kinship structure was like.
It sounds like there's so many questions, which must be part of what's so fascinating about it as an archaeologist. You focus particularly on mud bricks and the structure of mud bricks. What was of interest to you in those?
I love architecture. I just love the way how the title of my dissertation was How Houses Built People. I'm more interested in not how they were built, but how the influence that the architecture has back on the people. So I could see these deep cuts that we had of the excavation where they had dug into the very bottom. And you could see that the mud bricks were changing. They were changing in color, they were changing in size and textures. And so I was trying to work out what did that mean about society. And so I did a study of the compositions of the bricks and the size and the shapes of them and how the houses were built. And you would think that in a group like this, everything was communal activity. But what my results actually pointed to that it was very individual.
So and people made their own bricks, not collectively, not at a communal site.
And it wasn't being made, like there was no guild of brickmakers, you know, like someone, and you go out and trade for your bricks. That didn't seem to be the case. And then I wanted to know if some of the special houses were using any special kinds of recipes. And out of the 89 houses that I studied, two were actually special. And that their recipe was unique to all of their immediate neighbors. And also that house had a special composition of artifacts inside it. So it had a leopard sculpture on the wall and it had a skull in the post hole of the house. So sometimes that was an example of a skull without a body. Mm-hmm. You would put a skull at the base of the post hole to literally found your house on your ancestors.
Wow. When you talk about a special recipe for a mud brick, what are we talking? Mud, water, straw?
It's the chemical signature of the mud because it has a unique fingerprint to around the landscape. So even though a basic mud brick recipe is clay and sand and straw or some sort of an organic find. Yep. And water, and then you mash it together and you form a brick. But looking specifically at the clay, I was able to identify that it came from a different part of the landscape. Now, does it mean that it's special or, you know, is more, you know, did they trade for it? I doubt it. But it was distinct from its neighbors.
Is mud, are mud bricks still used for building in that part of Turkey now?
They are. It maybe was up until like the last 30 years where the Besa block is and the normal red brick has come to replace it. We built an experimental house on site in 1999 and we brought the guy from the local village to come out and help us with his local knowledge. And he came out, you know, he's about 70 years old and his big bowed legs but he showed us how to make it and doing it in the traditional way.
How incredible.
But he's a dying breed. Those men and that trade isn't really around much anymore.
But how close would have been the way that he was building and using those bricks to the way people living here 5,000-6,000 years ago?
I don't think mud brick technology has really changed that much. Maybe the size and shape of it, but it's so basic and it's so easy. And there's so many parts of the world that are still using mud brick architecture. There's a lot of advantages for it.
And safe in lots of ways too.
Ooh, it won't burn.
It won't burn, exactly. Yeah.
And your heating and cooling bill would be dramatically reduced. I'd build one in Queensland if I could.
So when you, Serena, you know, spend time researching this culture and its architecture and theorizing about the kind of social interactions, kinship interactions, are you struck by how different they are to us or how similar?
I always like to go for how similar, that they're just people and they live and they die and they have these amazing lives in the middle of it. And that's the bit that I'm most interested in, is what was their life like? You know, you'd say the similar struggles, but it's not in the way that, you know, you've got family issues and you want to do your own thing and you have your own individuality. And that's what I'm interested in the past, is what these people were like. But I don't think they're that different, really. Just different times, different places, different circumstances.
What happened to end that civilization at Çatalhöyük?
I have no idea. It's really an unknown. It just seems to have stopped. The people stopped building. The numbers dropped. It doesn't seem to be catastrophic. There's no evidence of invasion. There's no catastrophic fire. There have been fires on the site, and we can see it quite clearly, but not at the end. It just seems to have faded.
And the fact that people kept living in the area and building on it suggests that there wasn't a contamination or some terrible psychic connection with that area, does it?
Doesn't seem to be, no.
You've got to keep studying. You've got to keep researching.
25 years, and that excavation is just finally finished this year, 2018, so it's done. And a new Turkish director has taken over.
Serena, when we began, it was about Egypt and your love of Egyptology, your fascination with Egypt since a very young age. You've developed your own personal relationship with Egyptian culture through beer.
Yeah, I have.
How did you discover the recipe for Egyptian beer?
Oh, this is, I'm working off of the research of others. That's not me. It's got started in the late 1990s by a scholar named Delwyn Samuels, and she's an archaeobotanist, and she was the one that really kind of started looking at the recipes.
How much beer did Egyptians drink?
A lot. It seems to be a daily ration. It was safer to drink than the water.
Why?
Because it was boiled. So it was boiled and fermented and treated, and so it wouldn't have had the bugs in it.
Does this mean Egyptians were just drunk all the time as they're building the pyramids? What does this mean?
Yeah, they couldn't possibly, because they're so accurate, those pyramids, so somebody must have been sober enough. We don't actually think it was that alcoholic, because it didn't go through the big ferment process that we do today. It was probably brewed and drank within a couple of days. So yes, it was fermented, but probably mild. But it was very nutritious, so the way that the process in which it was made. So the daily staple for pyramid builders was beer, bread, and onions. And that's what you got every day. You got your jug and your loaf and a sack of onions.
And a fresh mint mouth after that beer, bread, and onions. So the recipes have been discovered, and you made home brewed it yourself? Or how make it?
No, I got someone else to do that. A professional, not me.
So you had the ingredient. I mean, what were the ingredients? How does it compare to what we put in beer now?
Sure. So the biggest thing is hops. We don't have hops. The ancient beer didn't have hops. It was domesticated in China much later. So that's the one thing. If you drink a pale ale or an IPA, which are my favorites, they're very hop heavy. And that's why I like them. But in the ancient times, there's no hops. So it's just grain and water, and then flavors. And so
what kind of flavoring?
Fruit, spices, honey, dates. So the beers that we've done a pomegranate sour. So that's just a basic beer that's been soured with, I forget what it's called, but the stuff that you use to make yogurt.
Okay.
So it sours it a little bit, and pomegranates, and then a bit of hibiscus thrown in.
And how did it taste?
I thought it was fantastic.
Serena Love, thanks so much for coming onto Conversations.
Thank you for having me.
Serena's an archaeologist who spent many serious years digging in Turkey, but also some frivolous times at the brewery with beer. This is Conversations. I'm Sarah Kanoski.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Sarah Kanoski. For more Conversations interviews, head to the website abc.net.au/conversations.